Hello, good evening. I'm going to call this meeting to order, and I want to make some changes in the order of presentations, and the DA is here. She had missed an occasion last week because she was not feeling well.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman, do we have a quorum?
All you need is me.
No, you need a quorum, but you don't need eight. We don't need to have eight votes.
That's right. Yes, we have enough to go, Peter.
Okay.
It's a listening session.
No, we don't have a budget committee.
Yes, we do.
For presentations.
For presentations, Frank, we do. It's been ruled by our county attorney.
Okay. There's no.
So what's the rule about quorum?
There's no voting happening at this meeting.
Okay. Oh, at no voting. Okay. All right. Thank you. Sorry to take
pretty
so
old
much
news
time.
Go ahead, Gwen. We're ready.
We're ready. Hi, everybody. We are going to look at the proposed budget for 2014 for the district attorney's office. And turning your attention to the screen, this recommended budget shows the combined totals for my office and the Stop DWI office. That's why the numbers are so high. The vast majority of the revenues you see there are from Stop DWI. There are a total of three revenue sources that are unique to the DA's office. That is the DCJS prosecution grant, the state supplement to my salary, which is $67,000 and change, and the third source
is Stop DWI.
Oh, is Stop DWI. Thank you. Are there any questions about this slide? This is pretty straightforward. The vast majority of it is Stop DWI reserves that don't involve tax dollars. If not, we'll move on to the FTEs. Our FTEs are stable in 2014 from 2013. They reflect the downward change that we made when we made staff cuts several budget years ago in connection with the cuts that were necessary then. Now, the over-target request. I'm making one over-target request. It's one that you guys have heard before. I am seeking to reclass the local criminal court assistant DA to a regular ADA position. This is an OTR, but it does reflect my continuing effort to get back to the status quo. Two positions were classed down from regular ADAs to local criminal court ADAs by my predecessor in earlier lean times. Since I've been DA, we have reclassed one of the positions. I'm seeking to reclass the second one. We've come to sort of a critical point in our ability to keep doing the job we're doing with the resources we have. We've made the cuts when we've been asked to. My guys all work long and hard, just as all the county employees do. But with respect to this one position, this is really a position that needs to be reclassed in order to do the work that we have to do. Our city court caseload has skyrocketed. In fact, our IPD case openings, our Sheriff's Department case openings are all substantially up over past years. We're talking about a net local share increase of $26,431. And basically, this is going to pay the ADA, who is the attorney of record for every single city court case that we open. We're talking about a city court that routinely has a pretrial calendar with in excess of 200 cases on the calendar every time. So this is not a new concept. I've come and asked for it before, and I'm asking for it again. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Gwen, let me just mention that this over-target OTR has been supported by the tenant.
That is correct.
So who has a question? Your hands up, please. Peter and Frank. Go ahead, Peter and Mike.
Presumably this is the difference in the salaries of those two positions, this $25,000. Is that correct?
That's what it would take to...
Yeah. So what are the different How do the job descriptions for the two positions differ?
This job position does not include any felony casework, no felony caseload at all. It's misdemeanor only in city court. It's a distinction now mainly only recognized in the job descriptions. The person who occupies this position has had to take some felony prosecutions in the last couple of years.
Okay, thank you.
Frank.
Thanks, Jim. Gwen, remember a couple of years back we got into several issues with the SPCA?
I do.
Where they needed to bring in, I think, expert witnesses, and you had to set evidence aside in a special locker and all that, and it took extra money. Are we budgeting? Have you had any experience in the last year with having to do that? And if so, are we budgeting any money for the upcoming year to do that?
Okay, the first answer is we do have a case like that right now. It's the prosecution of the person charged with killing the cats in Cascade de la Gorge. We have obtained expert consultation in that case, and the animal's remains are being maintained as evidence. We do not have a budget line for that outside of professional services. I do not have a lot of money earmarked for that kind of thing. You might recall last year we talked about this very issue, and my answer then was for expenses that go over what I have in my budget, I have to come back to the general fund with a resolution after the cases are settled.
You know, my recollection was that we backed you up with, if we needed it, we could go to the contingent fund to do it.
That's correct, because there had been a proposal at one point to earmark money, but it didn't pass. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
May I just make a comment? In the target budget this year in pro services, you have $101,000.
In
professional services.
I don't think that's correct. I don't
know. That's not all. That's a combination. So
right.
Mostly stop DWI
okay, but
money.
But it's in the DA's budget, right?
It
only stop DWI
okay.
money.
Okay. All right. 24th. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. 35,000, right?
That's correct.
Michael.
Still trying to understand you're over target, Gwen, so you got to help me here.
Okay.
Are we talking about the what used to be called the city prosecutor position here?
Well, generically, yes. But the city prosecutor position came to George when the city decided to give it up. George had it as one regular ADA. I believe it was around 2003 when three ADAs left the office. George decided to create two local criminal court positions. They ended up, in fact, being in city court. They didn't have to be. It was a budget. I believe it was a budget strategy on his part is the best I can glean from going back over his old budgets. But the person that occupies the position is, in fact, doing the work that the city prosecutor did previously, plus other work for me.
So are they working in county criminal court? I mean, you're saying felonies here. I'm trying to understand when this person would be doing felonies.
Well, because of the pressure of work, I have had to have him follow a case or two from city court into county court. After jurisdiction was divested in the local court, it migrates to county court, and he has tried some cases in county court.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyone else for Gwen? Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
You too. County clerk, please.
Thank you.
Mr. Granddaughter.
I'm a spectator.
Really? Well,
this is a spectator sport.
And Maureen.
Good evening.
Hello.
So our first screen is the expenditures and revenues. As you can tell, our revenues are going down a little bit next year because of the DMV license cycle, but we're going to take that into consideration, and we're tracking that. Our FTEs are pretty much the same. And we have one over-target request. It's for $50,000. We finished scanning the old library, but now we have to go through departments where there's a large amount of records and scan up the records. And we have four departments that have a lot of paper that we need to catch up. we will be using Challenge Industries as our vendor for this project. Here's our bunker. This is where all the county records are now being stored. We have a nice corner lot up there at Seneca Army Depot. Very safe and secure. Inside, it's all climate, humidity, and temperature controlled. We have all kinds of fire safety. We have the ability for fiber optics so that we can put servers up there shortly and do total disaster recovery for the county. We also have been working with all our towns. We've been doing a lot of shared services. We've received almost $300,000 in grant funding for this. And just I want to tell you, all the towns have been great to work with, and the city also has just come on. So we're doing a lot of work with them. They've been a blast to work with. One of the things that we're looking for is more grant possibilities. The state is offering the LGE grants, the local government efficiency. And we're hoping to try to work some of those in next year. We didn't have enough time this year to do that. And we're also going to be exploring additional state archives grants. Some places we see the shared services being expanded would be into the villages next or other further record sets of the towns. And I think that's it.
Questions for the county clerk? Will? Mike?
Thank you. So with your bunker, what kind of protections do we have against flooding, and how many years do we estimate that will be adequate space?
It should be adequate for quite a while, at least the next 10 years. We're trying to scan as much as possible so that no further paper goes up into it. We're pretty much storing our microfilm and our archival paper. We are taking some of the papers from the towns up, too, that they would like stored. Just as for protection, I mean, they stored nuclear warheads there. It's it has 13 feet of concrete in the floor. It has 4 feet in the ceiling. And then there's a water barrier, then earth, over the top of that with grass. So it's really, I think it'll stand.
Thank you.
Michael.
On the over target, which four departments are you going to be doing the...
The district attorney, the sheriff, the comptroller, and the health department. We've looked at up the sheriff's office, they had a big garage full of records. We've emptied out as much as possible, but we need to send them up to get scanned now. You know, as we tackle these, we're hoping to go and work with departments so they're not creating more paper in the future, that we keep scanning and bringing documents in and using this electronic records repository that we have.
Do any of those departments have money that they can put toward this?
None that I know of, but I think...
Have we asked?
Some departments don't think records are important as we do. So, if it comes to staffing and paying fringes, they sometimes pick that over records. It's very important to us, though. So.
Well, I'm just thinking that, archiving, ought to be thought about in the various departments' budgets.
Yeah,
maybe they're
absolutely
trying to get over the backlog is something we should be doing, but I would think that as we go forward, they should be thinking about that.
I think in the future that's our plans because it is – we're just looking at these big storerooms full of records now. It's to catch up. We did the library. Now you want to catch up departments, free up space, and get them, going in the future, and then we'll be able to assess, actually what their needs will be.
I have a question, then I have Frank. The OTR is partially supported by the tentative budget. I mean, tell me what that means. I know what partially means. Is there more money somewhere else?
Not necessarily. I mean, there could be, if we can save money in some other areas, there could be some. At the same time, we were just looking at how much of our reserves we were drawing down okay. to support the budget and decided that 90 was just a little too much, so we
got
them halfway.
Thank you, Frank.
Mo, can you say again first what the four departments were?
The DA, the sheriff, the comptroller, and the health department.
Wait a second.
You know, we see these as one-time problems that just need fixing, and that's what our goal is, to fix them. And then in the future, we'll try to do as much digital stuff in the future so we won't have to be scanning, back scanning stuff.
Well, would a combination of those, a part of that archives money that you're hopefully applying for, I'm glad to see you doing that, is any of that perhaps going to go against these four departments at $50,000?
No. The state archives and most places in the state now are looking for anything that has to do with shared services to put their money into, so any cooperative grants. So that's what we're looking for now.
The reason I ask is I mentioned to you as you were coming in that I mentioned the to Soil and Water. They're eligible because they're an arm of government.
Right.
They're probably going to be contacting you about doing something to store records. Or
sure. We'll look into that in the next grant application due February 1st. We'll just bring them in as a shared service into the teaser group. Let me just show you.
Anyone else? Thank you very much. Right. Mental health is next.
Thank you.
Aurora,
that's the longest I've ever sat without saying a word.
Go ahead. Did you want to say something?
Ask her a question.
Let me know that. That would work for me.
Good evening, Susan.
Hello.
How are you?
Good.
Are we ready to launch, Kevin? Okay.
Hi.
Go ahead. Let me just say that mental health in the big book is on section 4, page 251. And they have three OKRs on the list. Okay. Go ahead.
Good evening. We're here to talk about the mental health budget. As you can see, our recommended budget is pretty similar to that of 2013. The addition really is primarily about the increase in salaries and fringe. Our revenues have increased a little bit. We get revenues because we bill for the services we provide, and we have been providing more services this year than in the last couple of years. And so our revenue is increasing, and we move on. If we go to the FTEs, you can see that our target for 2014 increases our FTEs by one. If you recall, Joe in his initial presentation brought that to your attention in that during 2013, we had a contracted social worker, psychiatric social worker, that provided social work services in two of our school districts. That would be Dryden and Groton. When that contract ended, we worked with the Health and Human Services Committee and Joe and personnel and everybody who needed to be involved to change that contract into a full-time county employee. So that accounts for the increase in the FTEs. I wanted to spend a little time, there's an awful lot of writing up there, to talk about some of the influences on the mental health department, not just the mental health department, but the whole behavioral health services community. Right now, the shift in healthcare and behavioral health care is bigger than I think at any other time in history. And there's all these influences at the macro level that really end up affecting the providers of behavioral health services right in our community. So we all know about the Affordable Care Act. There's so much to that. But the pieces that really affect us is that the goal is to have all Americans have affordable health insurance. That health insurance will come with parity for mental health and substance abuse services. So the expectation by people who know a lot more than me is that there will be a lot more people who will be requesting mental health and substance abuse services once this gets up and rolling. And so there's a question about, is the system ready to really take care of a significant increase in people who will be coming into services? And why might that be? I think we know that at this point, for people who don't have health care insurance, you know, you have to decide where you're going to put your money. Are you going to buy food or go to see a mental health clinician? So when people have that choice, there's the expectation that they will take advantage of that, which will be a good thing. Another thing that affects the behavioral health community, because we're a little bit behind the medical community in terms of getting on board with electronic health records. And why is this important? One of the things in the Affordable Care Act is that providers need to be able to communicate with other providers. So you really need to have the technology, which comes through electronic health records and the ability to link with a larger database where all of our information is going to be sitting, and then with the appropriate releases, we can bring it out. But the idea is that providers will have health information in real time, not 6 weeks, 8 weeks later, but in real time, so that when your doctor or when a psychiatrist looks at this larger database, it will help to inform the care that's provided. So this is, you know, an expensive proposition for our smaller not-for-profit agencies. Some of the other influences, if we look at the Governor Cuomo's Medicaid redesign team, that was in response to realizing, of course, that the Medicaid spending was unsustainable. And so the governor put together a team to look at how do you control Medicaid spending. Some of the things that came out of that, again, that affects our area is that there was a recommendation that all of behavioral health care, and that would mean mental health, substance abuse, and developmental disabilities, these are populations that have traditionally been carved out of any kind of managed care. And so we have continued to have a special way of being paid for that has been deficit funded and fee for service. Through this team, the idea is that all of these services that are provided will be under a managed care program, and it will be managed by not for-profit managed care companies. So of course there's questions about whether or not these companies really understand how to work with the populations that are most seriously ill. Some of the other things that have come out in this whole agreement is that there would be development of health homes. Health homes have been talked about a lot, but primarily what that's about is the idea of people who are high-end users of Medicaid would have one person who helps to manage their care. So if I'm a person and I have have schizophrenia, and I also have diabetes, and I have other medical issues, then I have one person who's sort of looking at me from a holistic point of view and helping to make sure that I get to all of the providers that I need to get to in order to get my care in the community. The idea of this is that it would then help to keep people out of the hospital for what they consider non-essential hospitalizations. So the idea is, how do you help people get preventive care, early care, so that the costs stay somewhat contained? In the future, what we're looking at is that we will have to have a clear medical necessity for treatment. That's fine. We already do. But what that means, because that's a word that gets used a lot, what that means is that people will need to have a clear diagnosis of a mental illness and then also be able to show that there are symptoms that interfere with their ability to function in the community. They also talk about the fact that payment may be based on performance. Are we able to show outcomes in treatment? So some of this sounds easy, but when you're talking about mental illness, it isn't a linear progression. It's really a up and down. Sometimes people do really well, and then they have a reoccurrence of their illness. And so it's not so you have a cut, you get stitches, you get better. It really is a longer-term, circular kind of illness that never really goes away. So those are some things that we have to pay attention to. Another major issue is in this year, there was the HIPAA high-tech omnibus rule was passed. I'm sure people have heard of HIPAA. That's about confidentiality of client data. The high-tech version of that, very simply, was about how do you protect the electronic version of the client data. Earlier this year, in January, they passed what's called the HIPAA high-tech omnibus rule, which brought both of those acts together, clarified it, and then made it much more strict and mandatory to follow. So it really gets very complicated, and it gets a little bit overwhelming when you start to look at it. But if I keep it very simple, what the law says is that we have to be more aware and more attentive to how we're protecting data, our client-protected health information, at the point that we receive it from someone else, at the point that we transmit it to another agency, at the point that we create it, and at the point that we store it. So there's those four areas that are we paying attention to how we protect that data. A significant issue with this is that if we're not in compliance with this, there can be very large fines. And an example of that is there was a situation in California, and in fact, I just saw a commercial on TV about this, but someone had a laptop that was not encrypted, that was not password protected, but it did have patient information on it. The computer was lost, and the individual was given a fine of about $250,000. So the federal government is taking this very seriously. And they plan to audit people, everyone, big, small, in between, in terms of are we in compliance, in terms of protecting client information. And part of the reason that this becomes so important is that there are a lot of people out there who are fishing for this kind of data because it's marketable. So it's a place that they really want to. That data is very marketable right now, and not in a good way. Another issue that's affecting our agency is the OMH Regional Centers of Excellence. I think you have had conversations about that in terms of if the plan goes through as it's written. So at some point in 2014, both Greater Binghamton Health Center and Elmira Psychiatric Center will be, the inpatient beds will be closed. There are currently 3 adult units at both hospitals and 2 children and adolescent units at both hospitals. So that would be a total of 8 units, and each of those units have roughly the capacity for roughly 25 people. The kids might be a little bit smaller. So Binghamton, I believe, has a capacity for 115 beds and Elmira 100 beds, inpatient psychiatric. That's a lot of beds to lose out of the community. If they do this, one of the issues that I don't know if people are aware, it leaves the 15 counties of that these two hospitals serve with 6 adolescent inpatient beds, and those 6 beds will be at Cayuga Medical. St. James Hospital is closing, and if they take away the psychiatric inpatient beds, there will be a real challenge for families with children who need some sort of psychiatric hospitalization. They will have to travel at a minimum to Utica or Buffalo, and for adults, they would have to travel either to Syracuse or Buffalo. And, of course, the plan, from my perspective, lacks details in terms of what the state's thinking is in terms of how are you going to meet the needs of those people within the community. I don't see where they're talking about reinvesting that money except through their employees. How are these people going to be receive the care they need within the community? So if we look at our department, it really has had an impact on all of these influences. Really do have an impact on the way our staff has been asked to provide services. There's much more attention to non-clinical work. I think our staff feels very proud of being able to provide high-quality clinical care, and that's been the focus. Unfortunately, with all of the issues in the macro world, we also have to pay a lot more attention to those non-clinical things like documentation and making sure that we have all of our I's dotted and T's crossed. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it certainly is a change in how work has been done. There's also some shifting in terms of when I mentioned health homes, our traditional case management program is shifting to becoming a care coordination program. That means that they will have much higher caseloads. The funding will be different. It's a whole different model of care. So what are our goals? My goal, although I think sometimes people think I forget it, but the core of why the mental health clinic exists really is about how do we continue to provide high-quality mental health services to those individuals who present with symptoms of mental illness, which interfere with their ability to function in their everyday life. That's really what we're all about. That's the core of what we do. And that's really my primary goal in terms of what we work toward in the next year and many years to come. How do we get there? We help, if we can maintain full staffing, it helps us to meet the needs of the people who are knocking on our door. We need to do some work internally to successfully transition some of our programs into newer models that are more fiscally viable and that meet the requirements of the new era. We have to maintain compliance with all of our regulations, including the Office of Mental Health, the Medicaid Inspector General, the Office of Civil Rights, for the HIPAA and HITECH rule. We want to continue the process for full implementation of our electronic health record system and continue some of the things that we started last year, which was a process towards centralized reception, centralized scheduling, and concurrent documentation. In terms of our over-target requests, we have a request for 3 cars. The department currently has 12 cars. 7 of them are either 2001 or 2003 models. So I'm not quite sure what else to say. They're old. People laugh when they hear about our fleet. But they're old. The cost of repairing them increases. The highway department has been very good to us in terms of doing many of our repairs. And we do the normal, everyday kind of repairs. But obviously, as they get older, more things go wrong and the repair costs go up. So we're looking to, and those cars are used pretty much every day for our case managers, for our continuing day treatment program. So they don't just sit there, they really are used. Our computers, we're kind of in the same boat with them, in that roughly 75% of our current computers are 5 years or older. In terms of keeping up with technology and having systems that can keep up with the technology that we're required to have, it's important to be able to continue to update them. And in this year, we did get some what was called HIP money. It's Health Information Technology money, which was an incentive to help us in terms of the health home The HIP money was given to us by OMH to assist our case management program in transitioning to the care coordination program, and it was specifically to help upgrade our computers. And so we used that money for laptops and other things that were needed for that program. But the rest of our department really could use some updating in terms of the computer system, the computers that we have. And the final over-target request is that our new mental health building is really over 20 years old now. And it's beginning to show its wear. And one of the places that it shows its wear is in our boardroom and our conference room in the administrative era, in the administrative floor. The chairs in our boardroom are over 20 years old. Facilities has talked about the fact that they're not fixable anymore. They are reaching a point of being a safety issue in terms of people sit in them and go flying back. It's really not a good thing. The table in our conference room is well over 30 years old. It already collapsed once on a group of people. That also is not fixable. So we have what we have done in our regular budget is that we continue to work toward upgrading our staff workstations, so we make sure that people are taken care of around ergonomic needs and new chairs and new workstations as appropriate. We certainly have looked to get furniture that was for free or for very low costs for other parts of our department, but it would be tough to do this this project without some assistance.
Questions for the department? Will.
Thank you, Susan. That's a very, very good overview. First off, we're supposed to ask 12 questions, but I'm not allowed to phrase this. I'm just delighted to see that you're thinking about changing the boardroom furniture. You know, I've sat in those chairs, and beyond being dangerous, they also were designed to make us feel like we're in third grade. So you literally are so low, you know. So the question is, will you do better in terms of, you know, a more ergonomic and an adult-appropriate furniture?
Yes, definitely.
We've got my support on that.
Thank you.
I am concerned about the slide that talked about sort of the shift toward demonstrable outcomes and, you know, as opposed to a maintenance model, and how that affects the very long-standing day treatment programs or whatever. You also mentioned that the fiscal model on which they were based is no longer going to be sustainable. What is the plan to transition that? And
in terms of the continuing day, the adult continuing day treatment wellness program, I can say that. It really, OMH has come out with a newer model. That particular model was really developed in the day when they were beginning to release people out of the psychiatric centers, and it really was about giving people a safe place to go, giving them something to do during the day. It was more about holding people and keeping them safe. OMH has changed their philosophy over the years to really begin to look at how can people not just have a mental illness, but how do you recover? How do you become fully integrated into the community in a meaningful way? So there's a different kind of model that talks more about recovery, about helping to prepare people to hopefully have jobs in the community or volunteer in the community or to develop some sort of meaningful activities that are not so dependent on the system, but where they can create a meaningful life for themselves in the community with it not being all about us providing it for them. So it's how do we help people and then kind of help them to move along. That
sounds laudable. Is that actually realistic for everyone, or is it just some portion of the folks that we've been serving for many years?
That's always my issue, is that I think there's this idea that everyone will be able to move along, or that everyone in the developmental disability community will somehow not need a sheltered workshop. But I don't think that is realistic. I think that there are some people who are so severely mentally ill or developmentally disabled that they won't be able to be fully integrated into the community. So how do we provide a balance of services, more of a continuum of care, where we can meet the client where their needs are, and so that some people may still need to have a program they can go to and be safe and have something to do. But there are a lot more people who are mentally ill, who with improved medications, with support, with wraparound services, can function better than maybe we thought that they could, or maybe better than they could in the past because medications have improved.
I apologize for one last question. I was very interested in the story told about the data and what you're trying to do to ensure the security data and the fines that one can incur.
Yeah, they're very large. It's scary.
Do we need to be doing anything in terms of insurance protection, upping our liability? And I assume that would be our liability as a county for our employees, not the individual workers, or is it both?
That's actually a question for me. I have wondered. I haven't seen any literature really where it talks about more of a public government type agency. It really, I'm more familiar with where they talk about more private agencies. So I'm not sure I know how to answer that question. I think it's something that we need to look at a little bit more carefully.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how we would ensure that risk, manage that risk. My sense is that the insurance carriers, if they provide that kind of coverage, would ask us to do the same kinds of things to protect against that risk that we're trying to do on our own, to be able to come into compliance. So it kind of gets us to the same place. Like Sue, I haven't heard of any coverage for this kind of a gotcha environment. We can take a look, Will, but again, even if it was out there, I think they would tell us, you must do if you want to buy this.
I mean, I'm sure that's what they would tell us, but, $250,000 could be a budget buster. And if there's any way to I don't know how gotcha, how aggressive they are in terms of enforcement, but, Thank you.
I want to just say, too, that on a little different vein, we've been concentrating in the department trying to address the issues that we need to address. For example, some of the money that Sue talked about earlier. We're not just purchasing laptops. We're purchasing locking top cases. We're purchasing encryption. We're working with IT here to make sure that all of our information is protected. And we're doing a lot of training of staff and making sure that a lot of those steps have been taken. And we worked, maybe within the last 6 months, we've been working with Joe to create and develop a position of a security and privacy officer who is housed in mental health, but she'll be working throughout the county departments. She sleeps and eats this information. I swear she has you know, a stack of papers under her pillow. But she's just diving right in, and it's been really. We feel like we have someone there that's really watching.
Right. Thank you.
Carol, Pam, Frank.
Yeah, thanks. I'm trying to understand how you've changed the staff around to accommodate the new approach. So it looks to me as though the number of caseworkers, I just lost it, the number of caseworkers is reduced from 11 to 9, and you're picking up some positions. But my question is, sort of, how are you moving staff around to fit into the new programs, and do we end up with a total number of case workers, even though they're going to be in the holistic program, and it looks like we're zeroing out the intensive case management and the supported case management, what's the effect on the number of people available to work with clients?
Well, you're right that the intensive case management and supportive case management program are being zeroed out, but at the same time you'll see another category called health home care coordinators, and most of the caseworkers are moved into that. But it is true because the way the health homes have rolled out across the state, it was rolled out in three different phases. It's really been somewhat slow. And so I have moved some people out of that program and into other areas of the department where they were needed. One person left, and I believe we changed that position from a caseworker to a something else. No, we had a nurse. We had a nurse in our case management program, and we moved that person to another part of the department where we needed more nursing services. So we're really looking to where is the majority of our business, and how can we use people in a more flexible way than maybe we have in the past.
One of the other areas that we need to really consider while we're looking at resources, human resources, our staff, is their billable services. I mean, we have to be very black and white about running our business. So there's that part of it, and also the care coordination that you're speaking of. The model, the fiscal model that we're operating under from the Office of Mental Health, is very different with care coordination. So we're not limited. Take, for example, an intensive case manager would have a caseload of 12 people. They would have to meet with them four times a month in order for there to be a bill. Now, as a care coordinator, now it's a per member, per month type of billing. So say, for example, one of their clients may only need a phone call to a doctor. Another client may need 10 visits per month, but each one of those is rated the same way. So as we transition into this new care coordination, we're really we're trying to maximize the people that we already have on board while we're getting lists from the Department of Health and from the Office of Mental Health. And we hope that we'll have enough people to take care of the numbers at this point.
So can you give me some idea of so the number of hands-on, that's probably the wrong heads-on, attention. So you're going from 1 case manager or case kind of person can handle 12 people
right.
to how many?
We're looking at possibly 40 case, you know, 40 people in a caseload. But as I said, it could be, you know, we're hoping there'll be a balance that maybe half of them may be a very small amount of activity, and maybe the other, you know, would be more intensive like what they're doing now. But it's certainly changing.
And that is part of the concern. That is part of the concern of the care coordinators and myself with all of the changes happening in this arena. That and more, I believe that there will be more people in the community who are more psychiatrically unstable than we have our boots on the ground people who have to work with more people, not less. So that's a concern about the way that the whole system is shifting.
And then, if I may, one other. I see the Skylight Club mm-hmm. is being reduced. Is there?
That's the continuing day treatment program.
That is
and
the day. Okay.
Part of what we did, because we lost a significant amount of money, well, starting October 1st, is that we did reduce that program to a part-time program for now, because we're in the process of looking at and trying to figure out how do we transition that to the newer model, and one that will be more fiscally viable, and one that will be able to still see people on a every day or 2-3 days a week basis. Because I think, again, that the community will need that type of programming for as the future comes, particularly if they close the psych centers.
Pam, go ahead.
I have a couple of questions. Thank you very much. Your presentation was excellent.
Thank you.
But I find this all very distressing, and I'm hoping it's not as bad as what I'm thinking it is. But I'm sort of curious on the continuing day treatment wellness program. You say that it has to be shifting toward a newer, more physically viable program. And what does that exactly mean?
Did I say physically or fiscally?
Fiscally.
Fiscally. Yeah, that's what we were talking about. That's what we've been talking about. The continuing day treatment program has been a program where people could come and there was an expectation that people would show up. But that model is not being supported by OMH. OMH would like to see a model where people stay for a shorter period of time, that they don't come and stay for 20 years, that they come and stay for a year or two and build skills and find better coping mechanisms to deal with their illness and to find ways in the community to have a meaningful life. And so we're looking in this whole transition at how do we position ourselves and be able to provide a different kind of programming.
And we're also looking at doing some collaborative work with other agencies in the community in that regard. You know, a lot of us have like clients, and you know, we have to take that dollar and
well,
spread
that's
it around.
What it sounds like. It just sounds like that they are reducing
yes.
the actual amount of services and care for these people, which I find just horribly distressing.
It is.
The other question in the area, but it was the Medicaid redesign team and mm-hmm. the recommendations that they came up with. And I'm just curious that they were making this or being managed by a for-profit insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
And the implications of that, this is why I just don't believe that medical services should be managed by any for-profit company. But how are they going to have the ability to decide what services are, you know, I mean, if a client comes in and needs services, and will they have veto power on that person's ability to get services?
Yes. And that is a concern in terms of There have been questions in the whole behavioral health community about, are the managed care companies ready or knowledgeable enough to manage these populations? Because if you're only looking at the bottom line, it's easy to say, well, they've already had one hospitalization. Why would we pay for another one? If you don't understand the nature of mental illness or the nature of substance abuse, then there may be some real difficult times coming in terms of people getting the services that they need. I hope that I'm wrong.
So do I. Thank you.
Frank Jim Bryan, Carol Dooley.
Thanks, Jim. I want to first address Will's question about insurance on the HIPAA, HICAP. On the private side, there are policies called errors and omissions. I don't know if the governmental side offers anything like that, but it's to cover for the very things that you've raised a concern about. Is that type of insurance available to the county?
I'm doing an email to Jackie Kippola to ask her if she's aware of any kind of compliance insurance, if so, what the cost structure looks like. So we'll follow up on this through the risk management side.
So the other one is we passed a resolution a month or so ago about the psych centers.
Yes, thank you.
Well, have you had any update on whether or not, I realize the session, they're not in session right now.
Yeah, I don't have any further updates in terms of, I know that there are many communities who have passed similar resolutions or resolutions that are requesting one way or another that OMH and or the state legislature relook at this plan. But where that is right now, everything's been quiet, or at least quiet out in the open. I have a feeling there's a lot of things happening behind the scenes.
Okay. On the consolidated budget page, the state aid is going down by approximately $270,000, something like that. The federal aid went up, appears to have gone up by a chunk, a six-figure amount.
Frank, where are you?
I'm on page 251.
Section 4.
It's the consolidated budget for mental health.
Frank, that mostly represents some of the money that comes to us from the Office of Alcohol and Substance Abuse Services, OASIS, at the state level. They've shifted some of those a large portion of the funds from state to federal. So
the net effect is probably going to be close to zero.
What'd you say?
The net effect, if they've shifted it to the feds, hopefully you'll get the check.
Yeah. But you know, actually, so far, I know that you talked about it in the Health and Human Services Committee meeting, but so far, nothing's been delayed. You know, we'll see. I'm still expecting some checks in November and December, which will be federal funds. Everything else has come our way that we've been expecting.
But the it appears that on that page, it appears that on the local revenues line, are those the reimbursements that you're getting from? Are local revenues considered payments from insurance companies?
Yeah, right.
Page 251.
I think it's just semantics. I'm not quite sure exactly. Let me see.
The local revenue line has, you're projecting that it's going to go up. What's driving the increase in local revenues?
That would be the money that we receive for our billing, for our services. And part of what has helped to increase that is that we have increased our, what's called our productivity, meaning that we have served more people. For example, we're on schedule to probably see roughly 1,000 more not 1,000 more people, but to provide roughly 1,000 more units than we did last year. And last year we provided roughly 1,000 to 1,200 more units of service than we had the year before. So that's part of our internal work to become more efficient, to give people tools to take away some of the non-clinical work away from the clinicians so that they can focus their time on providing services, to billable services to our clients.
Yeah, and I think, Frank, you've heard a lot about the clinic restructuring over the years, and we are actually all done with the transition, and we are in it now. And we've actually done better than we thought we would. And a lot of that has to do with Sue and our new deputy and, you know, helping to really do some more structuring and working with productivity. So I'm sorry I didn't understand your question, but it was in a different line.
That's okay. I got the answer. Thanks.
Let me change pace a little bit. Roughly how many different people that use your services go through your place every year? Do you have a number like that?
Well, last year we served, I believe, almost 2,500 unduplicated individuals, and we provided, I forget how many units of service last year, 21,000 units of service. So obviously we see people more, sure. Most of our people we see more than one time.
Thank you. I'm going to go to Brian, then Dooley, and back to you, Carol, for it'll be second round for you, Mike. Brian, you're up.
Thanks, Jim. I'm going to shift gears a little bit, too. Your priority two that has to do with replacement of computers and so forth, I remember a few years ago seeing this more commonly. I don't remember seeing any such requests in this budget, and it might be due, and Joe, help me out here. Didn't we increase IT's budget so that they began having everything on a replacement cycle? And if so, maybe that doesn't include mental health? Or
well, we've increased IT's budget to allow them to do more work and to have really help invest in bigger systems. They're not buying, though, the office automation that we're talking about here. So if they're talking about increasing the number of laptop computers they're purchasing and those kinds of things, that still has to come out of a departmental budget. I think what you are seeing, Brian, is we're, particularly as the cost of these things go down, we're able to weave replacement dollars into target budgets more now than we have been able to in the past. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably what you're seeing.
I'm just wondering why this particular OTR workstations, monitors, laptops, that sort of thing. What it sounds to me what's driving that cost is actually the office automation portion of it, yeah. which is above and beyond what we normally do. I'm not going to tell you how to do things, but that was actually the cost of the OTR and not the run-of-the-mill replacement stuff. Does that sound about right?
I'm not so sure. I think it's mostly desktop computers, laptop computers, monitors, those kinds of things in the department. I think as we regain stability, we'd really like to see these items that, in some cases, we're still buying with one-time money. You got to replace them from time to time.
Right.
I think we'd like to move more of these into ongoing target support. What I was trying to say earlier is, in some cases, we have. That's why you don't see it as frequently now as you used to. In this case, there was a lot of equipment that needed to be replaced at the same time. So the department had proposed the use of one-time money to do kind of this catch-up in office automation, and that's why we've approved it. But again, our goal would be, in the future, you're not going to see nearly as many of these one-time requests as you have in the past several years.
Yeah, I think part of my plan is it seems like the agency went for many, many years without really doing some basic ongoing updating of equipment, furniture, cars. And so my plan is, how do I get on track with that? And again, this is a one-time, a fairly large chunk, but then how do I include it in my budget and do it at a smaller rate more every year versus all at once like this?
Okay. Thanks.
Dooley.
Thank you. This is my first question is really small. I looked at the page that has your full-time equivalents listed, and under forensic counselors, there are two. I look at the page somewhere in here where the forensics program is, and it says 2.3 FTEs. And does that mean that somebody at a higher level, part of their time goes to overseeing those two that are listed? Just help me understand how to read this.
Well, the forensic counselor is a particular title, but we actually have more people providing services to our forensic population than that. We have four people in there, and their titles are...
We have a clinic supervisor, one psychiatric social worker, and two forensic counselors. And I think the shift that you're seeing is that point three includes the clinic supervisor who oversees that whole area. So she's doing direct service as well as working with the forensics. And I believe the way that page looks is, isn't there forensics and there's emergency outreach services?
No.
Just the forensics.
there
are ways in which we have to report to the state. That includes both of us.
I'd do better not trying to understand that, I think. Thank you. So another question has to do with your major influences pages. And you refer to how in the future your payments may depend on treatment outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen any hints of how that may be measured, any papers that you may have to fill out?
No, but I hear a lot of discussion about it without the details of how it would work, that more and more some of the managed care companies would be looking for specific outcomes. So part of what we're doing internally is, again, is how do you document things that are not always quite so concrete as... And so it's always been a push in social work of how do you articulate what it is that we do in a mental health setting, because it's sometimes not easy to capture in a if you do this, then this will happen.
I understand.
So,
it seems almost impossible in many instances to do that. That's why I wondered if you had seen any.
But I mentioned it because the industry, I keep hearing more and more discussions about how in the future they may start to look at outcomes. And it may not be, they may not judge me on my outcome with you specifically, but maybe with the whole, how does the agency do in general, in terms of do people get better, do people show improvement. And I believe that our agency does a very good job of that. I'm not so sure that we document it as well as we will need to be able to document it.
And I think some of the documentation that we're looking at now has to do with medical necessity, ways in which progress notes are written, and ways in which treatment plans are developed. It's a whole... new language, and being part of the electronic medical records team, I'm working with a lot of the clinicians. So because I'm a layperson, so I'm learning all of this new language and process, and it's pretty fascinating. And we've got some pretty amazing people that we work with. It's very medically, clinically based. Thanks,
Michael.
I have a third question, but I also saw Martha raise her hand. I didn't know if you had a follow-up to what I had just asked. Okay. My last question is really different. Have you heard rumblings among your peer group or at the state level of a move toward having New York State ask for a waiver to develop its own single-payer plan?
I have not.
Too bad.
Michael.
Just a quickie on your over-target for the cars. How large is your fleet?
We have 12 cars.
So this would be 25% of them.
25%, yeah. Yes. And if I might just remind you that seven of them are either 2001 or 2003.
Just they're classic cars.
They are. We're going to sell them as antiques.
Yeah. Martha and then Carol.
Thanks, Jim. My question is sort of a general one. In terms of outcomes and treatment for mental health, I mean, it's not like curing measles.
I know.
Or strep throat. I mean,
I know.
What is the field's record as far as, you know, people come into the system, is there some standard where,
and
you know, I don't know, you know, 30% have a year of treatment and never have to come see a therapist again?
I think some of the problem, and I'm trying to wrestle with how do we switch this, but some of the problem is that our outcomes are that, well, this person hasn't been in the hospital for a year, or this person has been able to stay stable in the same apartment for 2 years, mm-hmm. and that may be a huge progress for them, but it's almost like it's showing what hasn't happened, not
right.
showing what has happened. Right. So how do you flip it so that you can find a way to articulate it in a positive way? Because it would be easy to judge us and say, well, you don't know that they would end up in the hospital. But maybe they had a history of being hospitalized, and now they haven't been hospitalized. So it's that's part of why I put that as an influence, because it's something that I think the whole field is grappling with. How do you show what it is that we do and when we're successful? Because success may be the absence of versus the presence of. Success may be that somebody takes their medication 90% of the time. That would seem like a simple thing, but it's not always.
Carol, then Peter.
We heard from the library, from Susan Curry and at the library about a week ago, and we're having to help them deal with now a $300,000 a year structural deficit, partly a good portion of which is their staff is having to spend time on security issues and behavioral issues. Meanwhile, we've got your caseworkers going from 12-person people each, a certain amount of paperwork to, or computer work to 40 cases each, but not having to spend a lot of their time entering data. And you're going to have reduced caseworkers. Do you do anything to work with the library, the downtown partnership, the rural neighborhood centers or rural libraries, the mall? I don't know places. For us, it's especially where else we're going to see this need coming out in our budget. We're already seeing it, I think.
We have been working with the library in terms of meeting with them and trying to help them with some of the issues that they are facing. Some of the struggles that they're having do involve some of our clients, some of it does not. But we have been meeting with them to work with them. The other places that you mentioned, not so much. But you're right that we could begin to see more areas of where there can be conflict because there's more people in the community.
Last question, Peter Stein.
Referring to the question Martha asked a couple of questions ago, seems to me that not in mental health, but in other parts of medical disease treatments, there are a lot of metrics so that one hospital, one practice can compare themselves to another in terms of morbidity and how long they stay in the hospital and blah, 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 blah. Each, it's different for each disease. Is there any, and I can appreciate how mental health is its own thing and hard to put into that kind of a framework, but there are a lot of people that treat mental health, and I wondered, is there a set of metrics for that you can, that, that any organization can compare itself to find out how it's doing on cases, or are they just too hard to identify and quantify what the problem is and blah, blah, blah?
No, I think from a national perspective, they are beginning to come out with more metrics, as you call it, where you can begin to measure how people are doing. But that has not been typical in terms of behavioral health.
So you don't really have something, I mean, if I ask the question, how well do you do compared to, I don't know what?
I would not have that answer.
You would not have that ability.
Only
to that, do
that I'm sure we do the best.
I'm sure you do too. Okay.
But I have no no statistical kind of data to back that up.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, both of you, planning.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Planning, section 4305, and they have four OTRs that were covered in the tentative budget.
Good evening. We'll go through this pretty quick and mostly want to respond to any questions you have. So the first one, our budget, the change you see is pretty much in the OTRs. So when, if there's questions about that, that's really where that's going to show up. And so we, in our budgets tend to fluctuate quite a bit from year to year in terms of our model, our net local, based on different revenues from grants, and some years there's a lot, some years not so much. So it's year to year is sometimes a little bit not informative, perhaps as much as it could be. But we'll talk about the OTRs in a minute. It's supposed to come out. This is a big part of the story. If you look at our target for 2014, it would have been two positions below where we were in 2011. This was a year where Joe had stated there was an attempt to kind of stabilize the departments, and we're asking for less than a quarter of a position to try to bring us back to a level where staff is largely working full-time. A lot of people had had hours reduced over the years to deal with budget constraints, and we're trying to bring people back to where they were, the staff that we have remaining. But we have lost one full-time planner position over that period of time. We've lost one half-time support person in addition to reductions in other staff hours. So here are the OTRs that were recommended by the county administrator in his budget. The first one was to bring all planners back to 40 hours per week, where we had been a few years ago. And that amount would do that. I think last year we had brought in a request for money to match potentially some city money to add a staff person. And some legislators had asked at that time, well, what would it take to bring your staff back to full time? Well, this is what it would take. And that's what we requested and Joe recommended. Our second priority is funding to assist with the update of the county comprehensive plan, which we've begun already, as you know, the process, and intend to complete the plan by the end of 2014. And these funds would help us with outside expertise we might need, funds to help with reproduction of the plan, public outreach, all of those activities that go along with completing a county comprehensive plan. Third priority is an OTR energy program matching funding. It has been in the budget for the last few years and has been funded in one time at a one-time level, as is being requested here. These funds have been used for a variety of purposes to help advance our work in the energy field, a place where we are gaining more expertise over time, but where there's a lot of technical knowledge needed and a lot of research needed in an ever-changing environment. And these funds have helped get some of that work done, both through graduate students who have done work on specific projects, through consultants, through grants we've been able to get and leverage other funding with the funding provided from this fund. And the final OTR is to allow us, if we're successful, to accept a grant we applied to the state of New York for, to do a feasibility study that would hopefully lay out a path for moving the DOT facility from the waterfront site that we've been working on it since well before I came to Tompkins County. It's been a priority for the community for a long time. And something like 6 years ago, they said they'd have it done in 5 years, and so here we are. It's going to take a little bit of more analysis, financial analysis, in order to make a case to the state that this makes sense. So that's the presentation. And
questions, please? Pat Pryor, go ahead.
Could you just please talk a little bit more about that, the site feasibility, not so much about from the point of view what that is, but what's the DOT role? Do they have to approve the whole thing, or how does that work?
Yeah, what we're proposing, first of all, DOT has told us, although in the region they would like to do it, they bought another property for that purpose. On a statewide level, this facility, improving this facility, is not on the top of the list statewide. So these decisions get made in Albany, and it's not a priority in Albany. What we propose to do in the feasibility study is try to make the case that this is an economic development project and has a lot of advantages in terms to the community that should raise it as a priority at the state level, and also show how we can potentially fund and finance part of that move.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Is the idea to get it away from the waterfront so we can use the waterfront for other purposes?
Yes, and it would be used for private development that would add to local economic base.
What a great idea. Will.
And OTR number two, the county comprehensive plan, is that 30,000 for consultants or just added staff time? Or?
It's both for consultants and for other expenses, such as reproduction, advertising that goes into public outreach, those kinds of things.
So, I'm glad to see that there. It sort of confirms what I knew to be true, but contradicts what I had read on the sometimes unreliable listserv that our comprehensive plan was done and it was about to be presented. So it sounds like there's some work that can and should be done. So
it's a long ways from being ready to be presented.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Go ahead, Mike.
How are we doing supporting our advisory groups that you folks help with, like EMC, for example?
We have made that the priority of our support staff person. Again, in order to adjust to budgets, we had planned for a number of years, in a budget 2 or 3 years ago, we put in that when we had a retirement in support staff, we would have to fill that part-time, which we have done. But the person who is hired part-time, their primary responsibility and first responsibility is support of the advisory board. So we have a half-time person that's dedicated 80%, I would say, to advisory board support, and that always takes precedence over other work in the department.
And
anyone
many,
else?
I just wondered how many advisory boards that person on a half-time basis is supporting?
Well, they are supporting the Water Resources Council, the EMC, the Planning Advisory Board, and the Strategic Tourism Planning Board.
A lot on the plate.
There is a lot on the plate. You're right.
Anyone else? Julie?
If you are part-time support staff for mainly the advisory groups, were offered more hours, is that a person who could fit that into his or her schedule? Do you know?
I believe so.
Martha?
Yeah. I see on page 313 talks about the housing strategy and affordable housing. The housing fund is Megan's role. Remind us how many more years of money is there?
I think we have two more program years in that, if I recall correctly.
Okay.
After this year.
After 2014?
After 2013. Two more years,
okay.
I believe. I could be wrong, but that's my recollection.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Anyone else? Carol?
Yeah, just, so the DOT, they're tax exempt, I take it? Yeah,
yes.
Okay. And what's the size of the grant if we get it?
I think the total project was around $99,000 or something like that, and the city would be putting in a match to our $22,000. Then in-kind staff time would be matching an equal amount from the state, around 50.
Thank you.
Bill?
Back to the housing, I know that our housing study is way out of date, and we've talked about moving toward updating it. There's nothing. I'm seeing nothing in this budget that would allow for that this year. Is that?
Not for an update in the manner that it was originally done. We will certainly be looking at that as part of the comprehensive plan update, whether we can accommodate it with some of this fund, some additional housing analysis. It may be possible that that would be one of the things we would try to do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sorry, another question.
Yeah.
Page 310, forestry, $15,000, which hasn't been in there before.
This is... Well, it's been in there. It just doesn't show up because those are actuals. It's a challenge that we have virtually every year, or at least since we did the forest management plan. We have been trying to schedule a harvest on our county forest lands. We've gone out for proposals and gotten no responses. And so what we typically do is we plan to try again. We put in a placeholder of a revenue and expense without knowing exactly what's going to be involved. So it's a net zero. In fact, if we did a harvest, we might end up with a revenue as opposed to a net zero, but there would be some additional work in terms of preparing the property for the harvest and that sort of thing. But I don't know whether we'll be successful in 2014 or not. We've been talking with the state DEC about possibly coordinating with one of their harvests on nearby state lands, and that's probably our best chance.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Probation, community justice, please. There on section 4, page 317, and they have one OTR covered by the tenant budget.
Good evening.
Hi.
Good evening.
Get a little, pull that mic a little closer.
Okay. Okay. So I'm here to present the probation department budget, and the first screen does show our expenditures and revenues, which shows a very stable budget. That is due in part to our state aid being flat. We did not incur a reduction in our state aid, so that's 2 years in a row now where we've remained at the same level, and that's been helpful. Full-time equivalents, again, stable. No reduction in full-time equivalents from 2013 to 2014. And one over-target request. We had a $13,500 cut that we had to incur in the budget. We were able to accommodate $7,500 of that. We put in an OTR request, which was supported by the county administrator, and that's in our travel training line. So just a little background about that line. Probation officers, probation supervisors, the deputy director, and myself, we are all required by the State Office of Probation and Correctional Alternatives to receive 21 hours of training a year. It is a requirement that we have to meet. As a result, we have to have this separate line to pay for registration costs, travel, mileage, because we do use our own cars, and, of course, hotel expenses if that's required as part of the training. Goals for 2014, of course, we want to participate in planning and the development of the new construction for the day reporting program. We're very excited about that, and we hope to work closely with the architects on the layout of that new space. We want to continue our collaboration with the Tompkins County Sheriff's Office in bringing Thinking for a Change to sentenced inmates in the jail. I think I've talked about Thinking for a Change before to you all. We do supply that program. It's an evidence-based program that's developed by the National Institute of Corrections. I have a number of staff who are trained in teaching the program to our medium to high-risk offenders. We teach at probation currently 3 weeks a year, 2 for adults, 1 in the spring and 1 in the fall, and 1 for our juvenile population during the summer months. And Sheriff Lansing and I collaborated because, really, this is a good program to have in the jail for sentenced inmates. It was designed for offenders in the jail and in an attempt to reduce recidivism. It gets them to think about their thinking and their criminal thinking errors, and it's role-playing and learning how to behave differently so that they're not acting impulsively and they're thinking things through. So we are at presently teaching a class up at the jail in collaboration with a corrections officer who has been trained in the curriculum. Sheriff Lansing agreed to send one of his staff, and it's been an interesting experience. We've started out with 6 sentence inmates. We're down to 5. One did drop out. But we're hoping with this pilot program to see how things go, and we hope to, if things go well, to be able to continue that collaboration next year. Also a goal for 2014 is we'd like to implement the Ready, Set, Work program, and also an evidence-based program developed by the National Institute of Corrections. And this is also promoted by OPCA for offenders entering or reentering the workforce. So I presently have my employment specialist attending training. She's attended the first week out of 3 in Albany for this program. It's a very robust training with lots of after-hours work and homework and, again, role-playing and a lot of education about social learning theory as well. So she has another group to attend in November, another group to attend in January, and then we're going to see where that takes us. I'm kind of excited about the possibilities and the different collaborations we can continue to have, maybe with the jail for sentenced inmates, and also some new skill sets to bring to our day reporting program and our sentenced probationers. And then finally, just to continue monitoring the new supervision rule, I've also talked about this before. It finally did go into effect June 1st, and so we just want to make sure that staff is implementing that correctly and that we're meeting the program rule requirements and that we're doing good case planning with our probationers to achieve successful outcomes.
Questions? Martha, Peter.
Hi, Pat.
Hi.
A couple of questions about day reporting. You've got page 320 in the big book is titled Alternatives to Incarceration, and then the page 322 is ATI initiatives. is one of those, what is the day reporting program in one of those places? Or? I'm asking about whether day reporting, where it shows up. Is that under ATA?
3160, Martha. So that would be actually page...
Section
4322.
Page 322. Right. Okay. So first of all, how's the program going? We reduced it in hours, and aside from...
It's been very busy. I think we're presently at 17 participants. It's been great. We've been working closely with BOCES. We've been able to get some additional staffing from BOCES under our existing contract without having to spend any more money. They've been willing to work with us and to send additional staff, and that's been very good. So I would say it's going pretty well.
And I heard something about the GED licensing, and there was some change in how the state was looking at GED, and that maybe more of it was online or something. Is there something that affects that BOCES contract?
There's something that affects the contract, but you may be referring to there's some new rules with respect to the test taking. Mm-hmm. It's going to be more expensive. And you used to be able to, if you failed just a certain portion of the test, mm-hmm. you would just have to retake that portion. You wouldn't have to take the whole test over again. But the rules are changing where you actually have to take the whole exam over again, even if you just fail one section. So it's going to be a little bit tougher standards, I think. So is that possibly what you're referring
to? Okay, yeah. And so is the BOCES person doing that? Who's doing that teaching?
Our BOCES instructor still teaches GED, yes.
Okay.
And does placement tests and checks to see what areas of focus they need to work on in order to pass the exam. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And does BOCES get paid directly by the state for each person who takes the test or passes?
I don't believe so.
Okay. All right. I'm glad it's going well, even though we shrank it. And
no, it seems to be going well. The referrals are consistent.
Okay.
Peter Stein.
Hi. I'm just trying to grasp this notation, this notion of cooperation with the sheriff and doing things in the jail. For instance, at the jail, they give GED training and one thing and another. Do you do that, or is that somebody else that does that?
No, we do not do GED at the jail, I believe.
I
think it may be BOCES who comes into the jail.
Right, so the jail hires BOCES.
Yes.
Okay, so why then is probation involved in doing programs in the jail? Presumably these people are not on probation, otherwise they wouldn't be in jail. Or am I missing something? It just seemed odd to me that probation would be taking care of that program because the people presumably are not on probation.
So are you referring to the Thinking for a Change program?
Yeah, Thinking for a Change, yeah.
Well, what happened with the training is that the sheriff was going to send two of his correction staff to this training, and only one could go. And you need two people to teach the training. I mean, to do the course, you have to have two people. And so rather than let the program kind of languish,
okay,
really,
I got it.
We decided we would collaborate this time around and see how it
goes. Okay. It just seemed confusing, but I understand. Another question I had is this thing that we've talked about for many, many years about this changing the age of juveniles and how that was going to affect probation and how that was going to affect family court and blah, blah, all these things. And my understanding is that that is about to come to pass, that there's a bill in the Senate for doing that. I learned about this at the NYSEG conference, and that there was going to be a new court that was that was going to be created as part of the Supreme Court that would take those cases so they wouldn't go into family court. Are you aware of that? And I'm wondering what kind of implications for staffing does that have? That was always a concern, right? If we increase the number of, if we convert mature people into into juveniles, then that means they need a whole lot more help. So is that going to be a problem if that bill goes forward and is passed in the same form as it has now, a problem for you in terms of staffing?
I am aware of the bill. I know that it did not move forward a while back. I'm not sure what the status is at this point. What it will mean for probation is that 16 and 17-year-olds who are currently considered adults in the criminal justice system will be given appearance tickets and told to report to probation, just as juveniles are now required to do. And we would try to provide diversion services for those 16 and 17-year-olds to divert going to court. There's always going to be, so that will be more work for us in that respect, because there's a lot of 16 and 17-year-olds that the courts deal with now that we do not see at all. I mean, they do not come our way. They, impose sentences right off the bat, and we're not seeing them. So it could be more work that way. There are serious cases that are going to be required under this bill, just like with serious juvenile delinquent cases, that will have to go to the new court, and we'll have to, those cases may come back to us. They may be sent back to probation. So. How this is all going to play out is yet to be seen. I had some preliminary numbers of what that meant for us in terms of how many more youth we may be seeing under this new appearance ticket concept, maybe like 100 more a year. But it's a kind
you,
of...
You don't. I mean, you have any idea how much you're going to have to increase your staffing?
Not yet.
Because you it probably won't increase the number of crimes. It'll just change people's classification, so they have to have different kinds of services.
Right.
So you could probably look at the number of crimes now and the ages and figure out whether that's going to be a big deal or not.
Yeah, my staff will have to provide the diversion services and making sure the requirements for that are being met. Whatever community service, apology letters, working to adjust the case for 2 to 4 months.
It's probably going to happen, don't you think?
Probably. There's going to be some form coming our way, I think, yes.
Pepper.
Just back to Martha's question about the GED. I've been following some of the changes that are happening in the world of education, being a former teacher, just because I'm interested in it. In a recent article I read that had to do with the implementation of Common Core throughout the public school system, referenced the GED, and it indicated that at least part of what you may be seeing or reading about may have to do with the implementation of Common Core in the public school system. So that may be making some changes in the GED program also.
Carol?
Was Pat done? Are you done? Thanks. How many people per year go through all of your programs, and how many of those are, repeat offenders? I don't know how you track. Do you track that within a given year or over a certain number of years?
Well, actually, the state tracks that for us, and I don't have the figure right in front of me, Carol, but I could look that up for you if you'd like and get back to you on that. But the state will keep track of probationers reoffended, and they do it county by county, so I could give you that percentage. I don't want to give you a...
But how about the first question, the number of people or cases, however you...
Yeah, we have about 100 cases open in the family court unit, which that includes adjudicated youth and child support cases. We have about 660 criminal court cases that are open.
we have, now cases sometimes cross over, so we have people in the community service program who, that's probably about 30 to 35 a year. Our high-risk caseloads, you know, our greatest risk caseloads, which are very intensive, those are about 30 to 35 each per senior. I don't know if that this is helping you, but is that okay? Day reporting, we carry anywhere from, I would say, an average of 15 participants at a time. Carry, that's about a couple hundred a year.
Thank you. Duly.
Back to GED. I read an article recently that presented the results of a rather broad study indicating that what you learn when you study for a GED diploma is not what gets you to hired, that you may be able to do math or read English, but because you have not learned how to work in a group as you're needed to do in a business setting, for example, the chances are that even if you get hired, you're not going to be kept because you have not learned how to do that. And I wondered if in the tracking of results of people who go through GED with you, you have seen that happen. Or does the state track it, or do you know anything about that?
I don't know. We don't track that per se.
Because that's a huge shortcoming, if true, and it makes sense, unfortunately.
Anyone else? Thank you very much. I'm going to make a substitution here and put the sheriff in. He's been here a while and had kind of a rough week, and I'm going to let him come in and present his budget. It is on page section 4, 331, and no OTRs.
Sir?
First of all, I'd like to apologize for not being here last week. I would have rather been here, trust me. With that being said, we'll move on. Our budget this year, we're staying status quo other than the awards that were awarded to our role in Civil Patrol through an arbitration for, I believe it was the years 08 and 09. I'm starting to lose track, but I believe those are the correct years. Our expenditures, as you can see, haven't gone up much. Our revenues possibly are going to be down, and I think that has to do with a lot of grant money, possibly. Any changes that we've got there, I feel pretty modest for the times. Effects of the 2014 budget, we've created the negotiated salary increases, as I stated earlier. Vehicle and equipment, we've been trying to obviously use, I get a little too close, sorry, thanks Jim. We've been trying to use rollover money for that. We've been doing very well. Of course, also we had a vehicle donated to us by the Stop DWI program. Ammunition continues to go up. You all had a lot of grueling times with SAFE Act this year, I know. But the ammunition, just to give you a rough idea, for a box of shells, now it costs us $5 more a box. That's how much that's affected the ammunition. So that's increased somewhat. Our service contracts somewhat stay status quo, and but obviously we need them to keep the expensive good equipment that we have in operation. No over target request. Our numbers continue to stay the same. I'm not quite sure why we've always had a problem getting that 44 back. We've not increased anything. We've always had 44, and it took us a while to get it back to 44 again. I hope we can keep it that way, but it's just something that comes through the program. The jail budget, again, we are keeping that. There was no contract negotiated this past time. Unfortunately, our overtime has been up. You'll probably already notice that. One of the reasons for that, just to give you a quick explanation, is our turnover in corrections officers, people retiring. And the hiring process goes very well until it comes right down to the nitty-gritty of background checks and going through all that. And then if they don't make it through that, we lose the candidates that we decided we wanted. For whatever reason, sometimes they fail to tell us the things they need to tell us. And then also we've even had people go right up to the last minute. We offer them the job, and they decide, no, I don't want it. So filling corrections positions is a very difficult position for us right now. It's not a glorious job by any means, and it's very tough, and the hours are pretty rigorous. Again, in the jail, we have no over-target request. And that's pretty much it.
Let me make a little addition to your jail budget, Sheriff.
Yes, sir.
There is no FTE slide. And the jail slide would say 44.40 for FTE numbers. So questions now for the sheriff on either department. Peter.
Thank you.
When Deborah Niemeyer departed, you didn't fill that position, right? And now you're filling it, and so why doesn't that show up in the...
Okay, that's a fair question. Brian is waving at me. He and I spoke about this today. Do you want to...
I believe there's a resolution that's going to be coming to us very shortly.
Yes, there is.
You mean a matter of seconds?
Not in a matter of seconds, no.
No, we're not doing business here today.
No. What Peter just suggested, we are reorganizing the construction of the staff inside the jail, okay, with that position of Debbie Niemeyer as she retired. Ray Bunce, the lieutenant, now is in charge. We will promote him to a title. He's taken the chief's test. We have the option, I guess, to change that title, even though the chief's test will fit the title we're going to change. And... I went to battle with the corrections people in Albany, and after three meetings with them, I was able to convince them to allow me to reconstruct the figuration in there and what it should do for us at no cost with the money savings from Debbie's position and how we're going to reconstruct, give us an extra CO, and promote the corporal to sergeant at no extra cost. So that's why it's not in the budget, because there'll be no change.
Okay, so it's all the same people who are going to be there with different titles or something like
that?
Well,
not all the same people, but, there'll be
the same
as far as the person at the top, yes. Lieutenant Bunce will still be at the top with a different title, and we'll be able to take the corporal and promote that person to a sergeant and then have us one extra CO, one that, you know, put us one above the minimum staffing, again, with the monies that we save by doing this. The state wasn't for this by any means, but I finally convinced the Chairman Beilein to send somebody down here and speak to me personally after two correspondents, and we were able to convince them that our idea was not a bad idea, and they've given us the ability to proceed. I still have to present it to public safety, where you'll get more details and bring it to here.
All right, thanks.
Anyone else?
I think they feel sorry for me, so...
Yeah,
I won't come back next year with an operation, I promise.
That's a question.
No. I thank you very much. I appreciate it, and thank you for your time, and I'm going to go home and go to bed.
Okay, good enough.
Be well.
Rural Library Services, please. And they are Section 5, page 53, and they have one OTR that was covered by the tentative.
Like this?
That's good?
Okay, I won't do karaoke.
Fine on.
Okay. I'd like to thank you for letting us come. We're all here. So I'd like to introduce the librarians for those of you that don't know who we are. I'm Diane Pamela. I'm from the Southworth Library in Dryden. Susie Gutenberg is from the Lansing Community Library. Sarah Noble is from the Grattan Public Library. Tammy Kubinek is the new director at the Newfield Public Library. Annette Birdsall is, okay, the Ulysses Philomathic Library in Trumansburg. I did it. And Christine Griffiths is here. She is a board member on both the Finger Lakes.
Board president.
Just Finger Lakes board president, and is very involved in the Grattan Library as well. So thank you for letting us come. We really appreciate your support, and we wanted to take the opportunity just to let you know what it is we're doing, who we are, and what our challenges are. So hopefully I can do this thing well. That's who we are. We are the libraries that provide essential services to the small neighborhoods and villages in our county. We're the ones you can walk to, and we're the ones that know the faces of the people that come in to see us. What we provide many, many services for our citizens and communities. We have literacy programs for all ages. You're seeing a picture of a baby story time. We have job and test resources, state-of-the-art technology, do a lot of homework support, lifelong learning support, and community meeting space. We support the county mission by strengthening families and communities and enhancing the quality of life for our neighborhoods. There it is. We provide community connections and programs. Many of those you see. One of the big challenges, two of the big challenges we have right now are supporting the Common Core State Standards for Education and being able to support people with the Affordable Care Act. Our libraries are also a gateway to the digital world. 44% of Americans age 14 and up use the public library computer systems or wireless technology to access the internet. And 44% of people living below the federal poverty line in our areas and in our neighborhoods come to the library to do that. We support job seekers, give health information, tax support, homework and academic support, and most importantly, provide a social connection for people in our communities. One of the challenges, one of the things we see are a lot of new technology and formats that people come to the library and want to either be educated on, supported in, or use. Digital literacy training has become a big part of our mission as well, helping people learn how to use the computers and get their email and all those different kinds of things. So, to back up. Good libraries build services and great libraries build communities, as well as providing electronic and digital support and support for all the materials that people come in and information that people come in for. We're also providing community connections. In a program I did today, someone said, boy, you really are more of a community center as well as being a library. It's not just about resources anymore, but it's about all the other things that we do. Oh, and that was mini golf in the Ulysses Philomathic Library, where reading makes a hole in one. We're unique institutions in our neighborhoods. We're not just a repository of books or movies, but we're places to meet, use a computer, view an exhibit, or get help. And this was a Pause to Read program where a reading buddy came in with 4 feet. So one of our challenges is, with all of the increased demand for programs, for services, and especially for electronic materials, costs continue to increase. And our budgets are not able to increase in that level. Books are about 10% more per item. audiovisual materials, 8%, and keeping up with technology is always a challenge for us. So one of the things that makes each one of these individual libraries and communities so much more than that is the support that we receive through the Finger Lakes Library System. Someone needs some kind of material. It can be in their hands sometimes the next day through the Interlibrary Loan Service. And as you can see in the figures, Finger Lakes Library System in that van with those bags full of materials handled over 120,000 items for interlibrary loans for the six libraries in Tompkins County. And their reach is five counties. But for just our county, those were the numbers. And delivery services provide patrons with access to the collections of 33 libraries in five counties, which saves hundreds of thousands of dollars and tons of time. Those are the recommended budget figures. We're asking for a 1.5% increase to try and accommodate some of those increases in costs, which comes to the $2,321 there. Each of the five rural libraries would get an increase of $420, and $217 would be the increase for Finger Lakes Library System. Another thing that Finger Lakes Library System does for us, which isn't on one of your slides, is the Computer Network Services Department that helps us to maintain all our computers. At Dryden, we went from 7 computers to 13 over the course of the last 5 years with our addition, and our use of the computers increased 600%. They're constantly, if you put them there, people will use them. So the support we get from the Computer Network System is phenomenal. We can't do it without them. And Amy would like to share some, is that on?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Amy would like to share some thoughts. Did I introduce you?
No, it's okay.
She's the director of the Finger Lakes Library System, and she wants to tell you her part.
Yeah, in addition to all the wonderful things that our libraries do locally, I just wanted to give you a little bit of a picture about what the Finger Lakes Library System is and what we do, what our role is. Library systems are the statewide infrastructure that holds New York's libraries together by providing consolidated services, shared programs, and specialized resources that benefit library users, stretch local library dollars, and save money for taxpayers. In the Finger Lakes Library System, we do these things for 33 member libraries across Cayuga, Cortland, Seneca, Tioga, and Tompkins counties in a 2,500 square foot mile territory that holds one of the most diverse populations in the state. We represent these libraries, these communities, and these fellow New Yorkers in the wake of a statewide fiscal crisis that has left us underfunded by nearly $250,000 since 2007. We've lost staff through both layoff and attrition, yet are rising to the charge of doing more with less. We must continue to provide sophisticated, modern services to meet the need of today's library user. We must do so cost-effectively, and we must do so despite rising costs, the ever-present threat of further cuts in state library funding, and while embarking on a $1.3 million building project in order to better serve our members and achieve our ambitious vision, which includes providing enhanced digital literacy and management skills to library directors, tools and skills trustees need to properly govern their institutions, and the guidance and direction that our member libraries need to remain vital, sustainable community centers. On behalf of the Finger Lakes Library System Board of Trustees, my staff, and all of the libraries in Tompkins County, I thank you for your continued support.
Questions? Will Pam Dooley? All right. Well,
thank you, Jim. So I'm glad that we ended on the Finger Lakes Library, because as it was being referenced earlier, I was realizing I wasn't even clear who pays for the Finger Lakes Library. And
most people don't.
So am I right that you get your budget mainly from the state?
Correct.
And that you are basically the wholesaler for the individual libraries or the support system?
Correct. Kind of like a BOCES.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you also talked about a building program. I understand you're moving out of the Tompkins County Library up to the site up near Trip Hammer. Is that correct?
Yep.
And you're going to be owning that?
We have already purchased the building, and we're going to do about $800,000 to $900,000 in renovations and in addition.
Okay. And your issue is basically
flat funding or poor funding?
We received 22% state funding cuts since 2007, and this year, last year, we got for 2013-14 received a 4.9% restoration. So we're down to about 17% cuts.
And do you actually have a collection of your own, or
yes.
You just, so this is in addition, or this supplements?
It's a rotational resource. Okay. We focus on providing the resources to our members that they can't reasonably provide on their own, or that are new formats that are expensive, or that they haven't had time or money to develop into their own budgets to get them used to those formats, so they can then put them into their own collection development budgets.
Okay.
Almost all of our electronic books that you can do digital downloads or music, or there's some movies still.
Oh yeah.
Most of that has been purchased by the Finger Lakes Library System, which enables anyone in the library system to use that.
We spend about $18,000 a year on the downloadable audio and ebook service.
Great. One last question. When we heard from the Thompson County Library, they talked about basically their collection was entirely raised or paid for by volunteer efforts. But am I right that this is not the case for the rural libraries, or is it? Who funds your collections?
Mostly it's our operating budget,
local tax base.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much.
Sam, go ahead.
I just wanted to add something.
Oh, there's no
microphone.
Oops.
The rural libraries are all a little bit different. We have our own personalities. So our budget is some of us are association libraries, and we have money through membership. We have a robust book sale that earns us $10,000 a year, which is totally for our collection. And then we have a school tax. That is also part of our budget, and that's true for some of us, but not all of us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Pam, go ahead.
I just wanted to know where on Tripama Road your building is.
The building is the warehouse building that's right next to Tree Forms Furniture that they've owned for many years and have sold.
Oh, okay.
You sit right at the corner of 13 and 366.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Dooley Keeper.
Will covered my questions.
Peter Stein.
I'm just trying to figure out where that was, but I realize now.
Dryden Road, right near the intersection,
I misspoke.
So why did you move away from the library? Any particular reason?
A lot of reasons. Our largest meeting room space holds 18 people. We have 33 member libraries, and we often have meetings of 50 people or more. So we have to rely on booking the Borg Warner room at TCPL, which is always in really high demand. We don't have public restrooms. We don't have a public entrance. We don't have very many windows.
Okay, you've convinced me.
We don't have parking.
Carol.
Yeah. So do any of our towns have libraries that are not part of this group of the rural libraries?
No.
So Caroline,
well,
are there libraries there?
Caroline and Danby are branches of the Tompkins County Public Library.
Okay. Anything else?
Reading Center.
Thank you very much, all of you, for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for
the Tompkins Community Action are not here.
County Administration.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask if we could request something. I don't know from whom.
I don't know either.
About the libraries, what portion of each library's budget does our uniform contribution cover? Maybe Joe knows that already.
Are you asking what portion of for instance, Lansing budget?
You all have different size budgets and different funding. I understand that, and different organizational structures.
Yeah.
We, in recent years, have been contributing equal amounts to each library, as I recall. And what I don't have a sense of any longer is what proportion of your overall budget is our contribution.
And that varies with all of us.
Of course.
For instance, in Lansing, our budget is $120,000, and so it's close to $30,000, what you guys give us now, right? $28,500, I think.
It's in our books.
The county administrator.
It's in the book.
It's in the book.
If you look at the program summaries, it's in the book.
Yeah, you guys provided that information to me. It's in the budget book.
It's in our book.
So that's a significant portion of our budget. And, you know, it might not seem like the $2,000 would be a big deal, but, you know, the $420 in a $120,000 budget, I mean, to me, I'm just thinking our books are around, after our discount, maybe $15. That would go to our collection. That's exactly where I'll put it. And that is a huge difference for us. I think we all have different funding sources, though.
Section 5, page 57.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Bye.
Good night.
Thank you.
I won't see you next year, but...
I think we'll do we will do county administration now.
I really like it. I think it's great.
And Joe, is this your the gray sheet? This is an old one.
There's a I don't want to say beige page. There's a gray page. There was one of the titles in our roster that was incorrect, so we've made the correction. No numbers changed. So I'll go through our budget. I was hoping I'd be the last, so I could say I was the alpha and omega of the process, but I can't do that because there's still TC action here. Budget that we've presented shows expenditures up by about $47,000. That's about 6.5%. I'll explain as I go through here that virtually all of that increase relates to a one-time funding object that we actually had put into place this year. Revenues flat. The revenues that we get are room tax revenues that support the administrative commitment to watching over room tax revenues. So the net local, again, driven by that expenditure number, is up by 6.7%. But, again, most of that is in the form of a one-time amount that does not affect levy. Our full-time equivalents, let me walk through this one quickly. 2013, you can see that our roster has been at 6 for the last couple of years. The middle column, the 2014 target number, we put a footnote in there because it's kind of hard to explain why it looks like it takes a dip, but, in fact, it doesn't. A part of the deputy county administrator's salary over the past couple of years has been paid with multi-year funding. If you recall, during the bad times after the recession, we actually took this position down to a half-time position, and then we have built it back over the last several years with a combination of increased target funding and a multi-year commitment of about $15,000 each year that'll end in 2014. But because that's not a part of the target, that's why that FTE number dips in 2014 on target. With respect to the recommended FTE for next year, it goes up to 6.54 positions, and I'll explain again. That's a one-time boost for the program analyst that will expire mid-year next year. So that's the FTE, and again, as I go through the OTR, I think it'll be a little more understandable. We have three OTRs. You'll be shocked to know that I approved every single one of them. The first one is what I referred to on the deputy county administrator position. We have to request this as an OTR, but it is the third year of a three-year plan to restore the deputy to a full-time status. So it's a draw of $15,000 on reserves. So we cover that through reserves. The $4,500 fringe factor on top of it, we pay for with target money. And I guess here the advisory is come 2015. My expectation is to ask you to fill this $15,000 gap with target money to bring it fully target supported, as was planned in the 2015 budget. Second OTR. You recall that we created a program analyst position mid-year this year to do a couple of things. One was to give us more traction in performance measures, something that's been on my agenda for a long time, but also to support the budget work that's occurring in the office during a period of likely transition. This is all one-time money. This is really the source of the increase in the expenditures. It's $45,000 to carry this one-year position through the first half of 2014. Again, using one-time money does not affect levy. It will go away mid-year. Third OTR, Brian, this gets to your point about trying to build computer replacement into a target rotation. That's exactly what we're doing here. So we didn't have enough money to do a computer replacement in the base budget that we had. So we needed to do an OTR. We had a choice. Do we do it with one-time money or do we fund it with target? We're really trying to get these into a target column. So we funded it with target dollars for next year. So this buys, what, three desktops or two laptops?
Three desktops and two laptops.
And that's the sum and substance of the budget.
Questions for the county administrator? Peter.
Unless I'm mistaken, I remember talking about this computer replacement a couple of years ago, and I remember an argument that was made is that that ought to be at the discretion of the IT person, not the discretion of the department, because it's a technical issue. It's not clear. At some point when it makes sense to repair it, and there's another point when it makes sense to throw it out and get a new one. And that's a technical issue. And I thought we were going to do that for all of the departments. No, we didn't. Do I remember wrong?
As we look at our equipment and what to replace, we get advice from ITS. So we certainly do that. But these days, with computers being essentially commodities, costing maybe $500 or $700, they have a practical life of 3 to 4 years.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to get in that rhythm of at least having enough budget support to pay for a 3 or 4 year rotation. We wouldn't do anything until we've consulted with IT to make sure, one, it's needed, two, we're buying the right stuff.
Yeah.
So there is that happens in these.
That happens routinely
yes, it does.
In all departments.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you.
Wait. I have one question. What are you going to do without Kevin? You have big shoes to fill. Congratulations.
There's always another Kevin, you know.
I have another Kevin.
We have Kate, too.
Brutal.
Anything
you will be greatly missed. As you would expect.
Thank you both. And Tompkins Community Action, you're up.
And up here to the front.
And as you use the microphone about 6 to 8 inches away, don't put the microphone next to your mouth because it will just pop.
Good evening. I'm Lee Dillon, and I'm the Executive Director of Tompkins Community Action. I have the pleasure to introduce Sally DeLay, my board president. Sally has been connected to Tompkins Community Action for a long time, but most recently has been our board president since 2011. Our original request $50,000. Federal sequestration is a little tough on us. As a designated community action agency for the County of Tompkins, we write grants and implement programs based on community need through federal, state, private, and local funders. The largest source of our funding comes from federal grants, and we were hit quite hard during the recent sequestration. And that is why we are asking for an over-target request, $50,000, to assist TC Action. I want to thank Joe, our county administrator, for his vote of confidence in recommending the $25,000 OTR. However, I'm asking you today to approve the $50,000 OTR that we requested. This is what we face when sequestration was enacted. We have no administrative assistance anymore. We have no community relations. We made staff reductions in energy and housing. We shortened the Head Start staff weeks of work. We lost a lot of money. Federal grants require a local match. The feds want to make sure that the programs that we're implementing are supported by you, the local community, County of Tompkins. We serve over 7,000 individuals with very low incomes annually who are at incomes at or below 125% of poverty. Very, very low income people, very, very vulnerable to crisis. I thought I'd share with you what the poverty guidelines look like. I don't know if that's something that comes across your desk very often, so I wanted you to see that for 100% of poverty, a mom and a kid can't make more than $15,510 to be involved in the Head Start, early Head Start program, or to get weatherized. I'm sure you can imagine how difficult that is to feed a family of two on $15,000. The effect of the OTR, if it's not granted, could be a loss of federal grants which require the local community match. We've been very fortunate in the past few years in our grant writing and have been able to take the decreases in the county funding when you've asked. We've taken every hit, every decrease. We've asked for no over-target requests since, I think I've been executive director since 2000. But now we need your support to continue the services that we provide to your most vulnerable constituents. This sort of says it all, I think. For every dollar that the county taxpayers, through you, give to us, we bring back $36.90. This is one of the slides that was given to me with the recommendation of $25,000 from your county administrator. And then I've provided some statistics. We've been a living wage provider for 10 plus years. Got lots of volunteers. Our union organizing that I'm sure you were all privy to in the press was quite nasty at first. But as soon as we got rid of some of the attorneys, we were able to negotiate and conclude our bargaining in about 2 weeks. We're working with District Council Painters number 4, having a very good relationship. We met just last week talking about some Department of Labor grant that they can provide training for us, for some of our staff. Some ergonomic training that, I watched my staff bending over these computers saying, get your heads up, you're going to be all warped. But so that's gone very well. So we weathered that. It was rather expensive, unfortunately, but I felt like it was hurting our image. But the staff have calmed down, and they're friends again, and we're having a pretty good time with the union. I think it's important to notice that our tripartite board of directors, which is one-third public officials, one-third private community members, and one-third representatives of low-income sector representatives. We have a strong board of directors, an active Head Start Policy Council. We serve 7,011 individuals in 2,500 families. And we also have an economic engine. We provided local landlords with $7.3 million in rental subsidies to keep their apartments and their homes in good, decent, safe, affordable shape for some of your lower income constituents. A little more information about what we do. I think the past few years when I've come here, I took the hit. I said, hi, how you doing? Invited you to some meeting, and then I left. So I apologize for not being more of a presence here. We've been really busy. But I thought these statistics might be informative. I also think that the map might be a little informative for you. I hope that you can take a moment to look at that. it takes into account that we actually are serving the entire county of Tompkins. It shows our Head Start sites, our headquarters at 701 Spencer Road. We've had very successful home ownership program. You can imagine people that are making $15,000 for two people and in a few years are able to buy a home in this market, in this county. It's pretty impressive, I think. I know that you know that for most people, their home is probably the only asset that they have that they can actually give to their children. 24% of our current Head Start workforce were former Head Start parents. We make a real effort. We have a preference in our hiring processes for Head Start former parents and guardians. We collaborate, partner, work, whatever you want to call it, with amazing organizations throughout Tompkins County and all throughout the state and the federal programs to achieve our programs and our participants' goals. And as you can see, our staff receives a whole lot of training. These are a few of our goals for 2014. We were fortunate enough to receive a Tompkins County Community Housing Affordability Program grant, and we're just getting started on a feasibility study for the development of additional supportive housing. We have a partnership with the Department of Social Services, and our goal is to enroll every child in foster care under five and under and their families in the next year. We've got about 50% of them right now enrolled. We're very interested in increasing energy efficiency activity. We have purchased a centralized software system, which results in single point of entry. Next year will be the 50th anniversary for the signing of the Economic Opportunity Act, which created community action agencies. President Johnson signed that, and Sergeant Shriver moved forward the War on Poverty, of which we came out of, Head Start came out of, Big Brother, Big Sister, Neighborhood Legal Services, a whole lot of things that help people become self-sufficient. And our New York State Community Action Agency Association, which I am a board member and chair of the public policy, is planning a statewide poverty to opportunity tour, highlighting the accomplishments of community action and also highlighting the voices of people in poverty. So you'll be hearing more about this. We'll have a tour stop in Ithaca. We're hoping to, at the end of this tour, sometime in the fall of 2014, to have a documentary, a book, or something that we can share with you throughout the state of the voices and the accomplishments of community action and the voices of people in poverty. That's it for me. I appreciate you listening and
Carol and Will.
Hi, Lee.
Hi.
I am not quite understanding the budget. I understand that the summary budget, the front budget page for the agencies just lists the request from us, and then you've given us information behind that about each of your various programs and the expenditures and the revenues, showing that there's other money going into this budget pages. Let's see, 5-71.
Oh, you're talking about the
5-76. So I understand that you've got different.
Carol, what is the pages?
5-71. Well, so first I referred first to your full summary page is 5-67. And our template calls for that to just show the request from us, I think. So that's the target funding is 156,283, and then the requested OTR is 50,337, and the recommended and the total. But so that's just our contribution that you're requesting. And then in the pages behind that, from 71
to 76, it shows each of your programs and that you've got revenues from other sources and expenditures, and some of them your other revenues went up and some of them they went down. Mm-hmm. So what I'm not understanding is, so of the $50,000 that you're requesting, which of the programs would, you know, if we granted the extra $25,000 or of the $25,000 that is in there, what are we funding? What are the particular
you're
programs
going to be funding,
go
you'll be funding the local match. These projections that you see, these budgets here, were before sequestration. So the percentages that are on here, you would be, we would be supporting those programs that you are currently supporting.
So, for example, the weatherization assistance program, your revenues went down by $100,000. Mm-hmm. So this wouldn't cover all of that.
No, we're not asking you to cover the full sequestration.
Right.
We're so just asking you to cover the to contribute to the problem.
The solution.
I'm
let
sorry.
Me be more specific. Lee, so, are you spreading $50,000 over all these programs? Is that the OTR?
Yes.
Okay. And what we've said is we're only going to give you 25 in the tentative. So you're spending now $25,000 over all these programs.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you.
But my question was the fact that $25,000 doesn't begin to cover the difference. So are we picking?
Are you giving us more?
Well, we could ask for more, but I didn't want to be greedy. We've got a lot of work to do.
So but you've got to make choices.
We have to make choices.
You can still do or not do. And I guess, do you have any order of priority that you would use to figure out which ones you would still fund at what levels that we could see?
We're hoping to keep all the current programs that we have, and we're hoping to write grants and bring in more programs. So I guess if I can be honest, ARA was a blessing and a disease for us. We got a lot of money, $16 million during ARA, American Reinvestment and Recovery Act. None of that was unrestricted. None of that was profit. Everything went to programs. And for those 2 years, we were gung-ho, we're going to make this work. And I think that a lot of our effort went right there. And now a lot of my effort right now is grant writing. So we need to fill what sequestration had. Everything that we're doing right now is a priority for us.
Okay, and then the building on Route 13, where does that show up in here?
That's Magnolia House. It's not open yet. We're hoping for a December occupancy. That's 14 studios, large studios, for women in recovery, supportive housing for homeless, previously homeless people. And that will be under our supportive housing programs.
Okay.
Lee, ballpark, what's your annual budget in the whole, everything that you have there?
Yeah, probably around $6 million.
$6 million.
Yeah.
Okay. And we contribute to that $181,000.
Currently?
Well,
yeah.
In ballpark.
$156,283.
And if I'm correct, you're saying that you leverage our $1 and you gain $36 from that leverage.
Yep.
Okay. Any other questions? Pam, Martha, Will.
I just want to know, I don't see it here, and maybe I'm just missing it, mm-hmm. The number of employees.
We have, I think, about 98 full-time and about 15 now part-time. All at a living wage with health benefits.
Martha?
Tell me about the Section 8 program. How many vouchers do you have? Has that changed?
Yeah, that's changed. That's really a terrible story. Sequestration stopped Section 8 from issuing vouchers. We cannot issue vouchers until we get down. We were up to about 985 vouchers. We've got to get down to 925 vouchers before we can issue a new voucher. That's it's a horrible, horrible situation. I think that Section 8 is one of the best ways to become self-sufficient. I've been there a long time. I've seen over and over and over single moms, single dads, two-parent households, dire straits. They get into a safe, decent, warm, affordable house. They can go to school. They can get a job. They can. So right now, our waiting lists have just stopped. They were, when we were moving, about 2.5-3 years. Now I have no idea.
I don't understand what you said. You said you had 985 vouchers. Now you can't issue any new vouchers until you get down to 925.
So the way that new people come on the program is that I go off the program and Mrs. Lady, who is next on the waiting list, takes my place. We are now, by attrition, we lose, I don't know if we lose, sometimes it's a very good success story, about 10 to 12 families a month. So we are now losing 10 to 12 families a month, but we can't reissue that voucher.
Okay. And then, so you're going to, is the 925 going to be the new normal then?
I don't know. We don't know. We hope it doesn't go below that.
Okay. So your waiting list, even when you had 985, it used to be 2.5 to 3 years.
Yep. So we haven't closed our waiting lists. Some agencies across the country have just closed their waiting lists because it's like, what's the point? We haven't done that in the hopes that, I don't know, we've been a high performer. So we've always gotten vouchers from other counties that weren't using them. So we're just still trying to be that high performer that hopefully will maybe be able to go to 950. But we are a local administrator through New York State Homes and Community Renewal. We don't deal directly with HUD. I don't know if that makes any difference, but at this point, HCR cannot tell us that's going to be it. I don't know.
And does Ithaca Housing Authority also have vouchers anymore?
Yes.
So they
and they're going through
reduction?
the same thing. I don't know exactly their reductions, but they're going through the same sequestration. So I imagine they're on hold too.
Thank you.
I have Will.
Thank you, Jim. We've already touched on a lot of the questions that occurred to me. I've been watching the very slow process of Magnolia House, and did you run into funding problems, or is it just being incredibly carefully built? It seems to be taking a very long time.
Well, the first thing that happened was that the architect and the engineer and the city and the Dormitory Authority of the State of New York neglected to see that the high voltage wires were too close to the building to build the third story.
And it couldn't have anything to do with the copper facing being,
no,
being conductive?
No, it had totally to do with OSHA is 10 feet. You got to be 10 feet from a high voltage wire. So that took only about 2 months to figure out, 2 or 3 months to figure out. So we had a work stoppage in the middle of the project for 3 months. So I thought, well, you know, 3 months, that's not too bad. But in the meantime, the oil elevator got backward, the HVAC guys left for a long, you know, it slowed things down. So no problems with funding. The funding was very secure. It's just once you stop something that's rolling, you know, there's some physics thing about that, but it works in construction too.
Lee, who was the architect on that?
The architects, Travis Price Architects,
and
from D.C.
From
Washington, D.C.
So I want to try to see if I can't tweak this question that Carol was asking a little bit, because I'm still not clear. You're asking for another $25,000.
Well, actually, $50,000.
Well,
Joe's
recommended. That's great. You're asking for the whole ball wax. And I heard Jim say that dollar can be leveraged many times over. But if we give you that, if we find the way to give you that added and support Joe's, what will that do that wouldn't otherwise happen? And if we don't, conversely, what do you have other resources or bad things going to happen?
Bad things could happen.
Bad things could happen, yes.
Bad things could happen, yeah. We could not get our match for our federal funding. Federal funds require 25% local community match. It's sort of your investment or the taxpayers' investment through you to these federal programs.
Okay. Are we anywhere close to the threshold for that happening? Or, you know? Okay. Thank you.
I have Brian.
I just had a quick question, and it was some slides away.
Let me go there. Wrong way?
Yeah, I think it's right there.
Right there? Okay.
Yeah, the bottom one.
Yep.
Can you explain that to me?
Sure. People receive Section 8 rental assistance, which is called Housing Choice Voucher Program now, and tenants pay a portion of their income towards the rent and utilities. And we pay up to a threshold on their behalf to the landlord. So the tenant has a portion, and then
okay.
TCX has a portion.
Okay. So that's
that's just the
for rent. That's not investing in their rental property.
No. Well, no, but I mean, one could say you are investing when you pay rent in someone's property, but that is for rent. Yes.
I'm talking about repairs, maintenance, that sort of thing. I mean, they're free to spend that however they want.
Right. Yeah. And yeah. I know that. Because of our criteria, a lot of homes that we have gone into that have not met that criteria now meet that criteria. And whether they used the rent or their other earnings, you know, I don't know, but I would think that, you know, rent was part of that.
Okay. Right.
Anyone else? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And boys, men and women, boys and girls, that concludes our listening portion of the budget. We do have a meeting tomorrow evening, the forum at 7 p.m. in this room, and the amendment process begins on Monday, October 21st, second meeting October 22nd, third meeting, if necessary, October 28th. Please submit your amendments to Kevin, and we will carry on from there. Thank you all for coming, especially after getting home past midnight last night. I appreciate it.